Okay. I get to on behalf of the Graduate Division of the University of California and the Jefferson Lecture Committee, welcome to the first Jefferson Lecture for the year 2001. It's a pleasure for me to introduce the gifted journalist E.J. Dionne Jr. to you this afternoon, even though, having done some research on this, I can tell you E.J. throws major obstacles in the path of a conscientious introducer. Disclosing to the public neither his first nor his middle name, nor those of his father, Eugene Joseph Dionne Sr., nor his place of birth. He grew up, say his biographical blurbs, in Fall River, Massachusetts. His busy pen has made him, I suppose, the second most notable inhabitant of that modest New England community to achieve fame through the employment of a sharp instrument, the first being Elizabeth Borden, whose chosen instrument, as we recall, was an axe. Like many promising Massachusetts lads, E.J. went to the local college, Harvard, where he distinguished himself by graduating summa cum laude in the class of 1973 and winning a Rhodes Scholarship to Balliol College, Oxford. From Oxford, he eventually earned a DPhil in sociology, which is dated 1982. His dissertation, Oxford DPhil, those are sure everybody in this room knows this. Oxford DPhil basically is a writing degree, and he wrote on race, community, and equality. For 14 years, he worked for the New York Times, covering state and local government, and as a foreign correspondent in Paris, Rome, and Beirut. Since 1990, he has been a reporter, editorial writer, and since 1993, a columnist for the Washington Post. He now divides his time between the Post and the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C., where, among his other responsibilities, he presides with skill and generosity, as I have personal reason to know, over the most stimulating weekly gathering over lunch in town. His books include Why Americans Hate Politics, published in 1991, and They Only Look Dead, Why Progressives Will Dominate the Next Political Era, which I presume he thinks will start any minute now, published in 1996. More recently, he's written on the revival of civil society and on the role of religion in public life, the subject of his Jefferson Lecture today. In addition to today's lecture, the journalism school has implored me to say he will, at 3 o'clock tomorrow, be talking at the journalism school on the election, particularly the Florida phase of the election, or as I like to say, the Florida honeymoon of George Bush, with Mark Danner. And at 5 o'clock tomorrow, he will give a Harris seminar at the Institute of Governmental Studies on called Is There a Politics of the Common Good? Today, his talk is titled The Third Stage, The New Frontiers of Religion and Public Life. E.J. Dionne.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much, Nelson. I want to disclose that I was born in Boston, Massachusetts, and immediately banned, and I went down to Fall River. I write it that way because I want to emphasize, I was born in a hospital in Boston, and I am really from Fall River, a place that was once described as having, by a friend of mine, as having three kinds of people in it: people running for office, people getting ready to run for office, and people recovering from running for office, which kind of proves my friend Mary McGrory's line that every baby born in Massachusetts is born with a campaign manager's gene, and I believe that to be true. And it was nice of Nelson to mention the lunch so fondly. I always said Brookings asked me to do this because God made me to be the maitre d' of American politics, and I enjoy this very much. Also, I want to tout Mark Danner and his event tomorrow. Mark has written some of the best stuff on the recount. You could argue that the progressive era actually continued in this election, but we won't. We'll go into that tomorrow. You know, tomorrow is count every vote. Today is count every soul, I think, is the theme. There's a strong argument, I think, that only a fool would come to Berkeley and offer to give a lecture carrying the name of Thomas Jefferson on the subject of religious liberty. Who would be pretentious enough to think that he or she might add anything to Thomas Jefferson, the author of our country's statutes on and one of the founders of our traditions of religious liberty? When I woke up this morning, this is true, I had almost lost my voice, and I figured Mr. Jefferson was sending me a message from afar telling me, don't mess with this subject, buddy. And in fact, I think that's the attitude that a lot of us have on the subject of religion and public life. Don't mess with this subject, buddy. When I think of my inadequacy to this task, I think I really am the person in that great story of the heckler who confronted Al Smith in the 1920s and yelled out to Smith, tell us all we know, Al, it won't take long. And Smith, being a clever guy, yelled back at the heckler and said, I'll tell him all we both know and it won't take longer. My only warrant for this talk today comes from Alan Wolfe, the fine sociologist and social critic, who wrote a couple of years back something that I think is true and has been true for a long time. Wolfe wrote that 200 years after the brilliant writings of James Madison and Thomas Jefferson on the topic, Americans cannot make up their minds about whether religion is primarily private, public, or some uneasy combination of the two. And because I think Wolfe is right, I like to think that Jefferson himself, the man who said that the earth belongs to the living, would agree that this is a subject that did not die with him, and that succeeding generations need to address it in their own terms if religious liberty is to survive. Before I go on, I do want to say how grateful I am to be here and to thank Teresa Malengo, the Jefferson Lectures Coordinator, for her intelligence and for her many kindnesses. I also want to thank the committee, Nelson, Tom Leonard, Harry Scheiber, Robert Kagan, and Robin Einhorn, and thanks also to Marianne Mason, the Dean of the Graduate Division, and thank you all for coming, including some very old friends, including one I hadn't seen for 31 years, I figured, after you came up. Bridget, it's great to see you. I'd like to start by asking what may seem to be an odd question. What did it mean to be a good Methodist in the 2000 election? I ask that question because in this election there were two very important Methodists on the ballot in the nation. One of them was named George W. Bush, and the other was named Hillary Rodham Clinton. They were important for the obvious reasons, but also because I think each of them represented very different sides of the Methodist tradition, which itself, I think, stands in for very different sides of our own national tradition of religious engagement in politics and social reform. Bush represented the self-perfecting, self-improvement side of Methodism, the pious and individualistic side. Clinton represented the social change, social activist, social justice side of Methodism. That tension in Methodism, I think, is the tension in the current discourse over the common good and the role of religion in public life. It's a boundary that divides left and right, but occasionally also cuts across the normal ideological politics. On the one side of this Methodist divide, there is a concern for the common good embodied in an economically progressive, or you could call it social democratic or New Deal view, that emphasizes the social and structural causes of poverty and inequality and the social responsibilities that fall upon all of us to heal them. On the other, there is the view that also serves a communal role, to be sure, in resolving poverty, but often locates that role outside of government. It highlights the importance of individual personal transformation and conversion as essential elements in curing social ills. In keeping with Bush's version of Methodism, this view, and why not call it compassionate conservatism, often sees the causes of poverty in individual shortcomings or failures rather than in social or economic injustice. The emphasis is on drug addicts who must free themselves from dependency, former offenders who must transform their hearts, parents who need to learn to be more loving and responsible toward their children. What we see here is a communal language put to the service of what is, in the end, a serious but individualistic way of solving social problems. Let's take as an example Bush's very strong words about the poor in his inaugural address. He said, quotes, "In the quiet of the American conscience, we know that deep and persistent poverty is unworthy of our nation's promise, and whatever our views of its cause, we can agree that children at risk are not at fault." Now, so far, he has everybody with him around the table, seated from left to right. But then he goes on and says, "Abandonment and abuse are not acts of God. They are failures of love. And the proliferation of prisons, however necessary, is no substitute for hope and order in our souls." Now, given his record on law and order issues, it's remarkable, even moving, for him to bring up the proliferation of prisons as a problem. And yet what's important here, I think, is where he locates the cause of these social difficulties. Abandonment and abuse are the problems for these poor children. Hope and order in our souls is the solution to the problem of criminality. And if I could just use one more example, Bush declared, quotes, "Compassion is the work of a nation, not just a government, and some needs and hurts are so deep that they will only respond to a mentor's touch or a pastor's prayer. Church and charity and synagogue and mosque lend our communities their humanity, and they will have an honored place in our plans and in our laws." Again, there is a lot here that many of us could applaud, but whatever it is not the old social gospel, and surely it is not the New Deal. In the case of Mrs. Clinton, on the other hand, we know that her emphasis is elsewhere. "It takes a village to raise a child" was the title of her book, and it comes from Africa, but it could well have come out of the social justice tradition within Methodism. And of course, Mrs. Clinton's view of that village encompasses not just families and churches, and not just the mentor's touch or the pastor's prayer, but also the government itself. She has spoken often to the government's obligations for universal health care, education, family leave, income supplements, and child care. Now, I hope you'll forgive me my digression on Methodism, but I think these two traditions have a great deal to teach us about our contemporary situation. First, I think they teach us to be wary of assuming, as has so often been the case in contemporary commentary, that the word religious must always be associated with the words right or conservative. This is a mistake, I think, that gets made all across the political spectrum. It's also worth recalling that the emphasis on self-improvement and self-control that is part of the Bush story was once in our history intimately linked with the cause of social reform itself. Those who favored the prohibition of alcohol did not see it as an alternative to social reconstruction, but as part of a program of social reconstruction that encompassed economic and governing structures as well as the individual. Self-improvement was linked with the idea of social improvement. You saw this connection in many other moments in our history, in the early trade union movement, which put heavy emphasis on education and self-help, even as it also preached organizing and solidarity. And you saw it most recently and most powerfully in the civil rights movement. In his wonderful new book, which I commend to you all, Radical Equations, Math Literacy and Civil Rights, the legendary civil rights leader Robert Moses captures the magic of the moment of the civil rights movement. He writes, quotes, "The civil rights movement of the 1960s was less about challenges and protests against white power than feeling our way toward our own power and possibilities, really a series of challenges by ourselves and our community to ourselves. This was a movement that placed demands on society and demands on individuals." Now, in speaking with respect, and I do respect it, for this self-improvement and self-denying side of Methodism and more generally of our American religious traditions, I certainly do not want to pretend myself to a false piety. I am a Roman Catholic, and anybody who knows me knows I have no special sympathy for the cause of prohibition. In fact, I've always thought that Roosevelt and repeal was one of the finest slogans in American political history, that is, right on both counts. But to understand the complexity of the current moment as it entails individual rights and the common good, personal faith, and public life, I think it's essential that we confront a new division that has arisen between those who advance the cause of personal moral improvement and those who seek social and economic transformation. Two causes that were once allies now often face off against each other as adversaries. And yet, there is still a tug toward a public moral sense, a communitarian sense, if you will, I say that with respect to Philip Selznick, that provides public moral values within a context of liberty. That this is extremely tricky explains why the politics of religion is so complicated. The choice among competing goods represented in this quest was captured very well by Michael Ignatieff in his book, The Needs of Strangers. Ignatieff wrote, "We need justice, we need liberty, and we need as much solidarity as can be reconciled with justice and liberty." Just exactly how do we do this? Well, nobody ever said the business of democracy was easy. The current interest in the role of faith-based groups in public policy, the new engagement of religious groups in our public life, the willingness of politicians from Bush and Lieberman to Gore and both Clintons to talk about their faith in public, all these reflect, I think, a search for a common political moral language that tries to find a plausible route to Ignatieff's objectives. The quest for a new public language has become all the more urgent with the disestablishment of mainline Protestantism as the dominant discourse of American public life. Now, I think most Americans welcome the advances in religious liberty made over the last four decades, and yet I think we also notice the absence of the civic glue that those old Protestant values provided. The new discourse about religion in public life, to be sure, is more inclusive and tolerant than the old discourse, and I want to get to more on that in a moment. It is more conscious of the radically pluralistic situation that has developed in our country as Muslims and Buddhists, Sikhs, Jains, Hindus, and followers of many other spiritual traditions have joined Protestants, Catholics, and Jews in our great national experiment in pluralism. Yet for all its newness, I think the latest discourse looks back to that older tradition as it tries to mix a new civic glue, a public philosophy that matches individual and social responsibility, personal and public fulfillment. To seek such a philosophy does not mean finding it, and I don't for a moment pretend to minimize all the First Amendment issues we will be arguing about in the coming months and years as we debate government's proper relationship to faith-based social action. But the debates might be better, and we might understand each other more fully if we try to situate this particular debate in a larger social and political frame. It would certainly help, for example, if we acknowledge that almost all of us can be quite inconsistent in our views of how and when religion should influence politics. Many who welcome the prophetic role of the churches in movements to abolish slavery, promote civil rights, and secure social justice are skeptical of applying religion's prophetic voice to matters such as abortion, sexuality, or family life. And on the other side, many who welcome that second set of commitments can be just as wary of crusades rooted in a social gospel. Understood this way, it's less surprising that the Clintons and Gore and Lieberman, no less than George W. Bush, could find themselves comfortable talking about religion's public role. As Matthew Spaulding has argued, what Gore and Lieberman did in the year 2000 in many ways was to revive the old social gospel tradition of the turn of the turn of the century. It is a social gospel that is far more ecumenical, especially coming from Joe Lieberman, but it did see religion as a warrant for social justice. Eyebrows were raised, for example, when Lieberman said that the commandment to honor thy father and thy mother was a warrant for Medicare. The social gospelers would not have been surprised by that at all. This was just one of many signs of the times we've seen over the last year. In the earliest stages of the 2000 campaign, both Bush and Vice President Gore spoke enthusiastically about what government could do to help those faith-based organizations. Joe Lieberman pleaded for an enlarged role for faith in the public square in speeches delivered at a church in Detroit and at Notre Dame. I once offered a little quiz quoting Gore, Lieberman, and Bush on faith-based institutions and asking which one of these was Bush's statement. Only one of them came from Bush. The other two came from Gore and Lieberman. And if it's okay at Berkeley to quote George Wallace, there really wasn't a dime's worth of difference among the three statements. Joe Lieberman also, as we know, spoke unabashedly about his commitment to Orthodox Judaism and to the contributions that faith could make to America's civic life. And while it was missed in the midst of the Lewinsky affair, former President Clinton got into the mix as well. At a White House prayer breakfast with religious leaders, he embraced what he called, quotes, an emerging consensus about the ways in which faith organizations and our government can work together. And then, of course, there was George Bush's famous moment in which he announced that Jesus Christ was his favorite political philosopher. So what's going on here? Is the wall between church and state tumbling down? Not at all. But the turn of the millennium, I think, may well be remembered as a time when the country renegotiated the relationship between religion and public life, faith and culture. Don't be scared. We are not about to chuck religious freedom, impose censorship, or herd everyone into a church or a synagogue or a mosque. Indeed, it is partly because of advances in religious liberty, the result of court decisions and cultural changes that occurred during the 1960s, that it is even possible to talk now about new forms of cooperation between the religious and the political worlds. The current moment, I believe, is best understood as the third stage in our great national debate over religious liberty. The first stage might be seen as a time of white Protestant hegemony, and it lasted well into the 20th century. Protestantism did much to shape the national character and our nation's identity, to the point where American Jews and Catholics and Muslims were more than a little bit Protestant. In fact, my friends in the Vatican used to note to me when I covered the place as a journalist in the mid-1980s. Congregations, or more accurately for that time, churches, drew upon this shared Protestant spirit to connect people to one another and to the institutions of their common democracy. If not everyone shared in the Protestant identity in a theological sense, everyone more or less identified with the institutions it upheld. And of course, it was one of the great virtues of American Protestantism that it underwrote religious toleration and religious liberty. It is that commitment to religious liberty that allowed Catholics and Jews and then many others to settle here and ultimately to help unsettle Protestant dominance. Now, white Protestant hegemony in America, the first stage, began to erode. I think it began to erode with the Scopes trial back in the 20s, and especially with the end of Prohibition, arguably the last political project to unite mainline and fundamentalist Protestants. But the formal dominance of Protestantism, I think, was repealed in the 1960s with, it must be said, the strong support of many moderate and progressive Protestants themselves. The second stage involved a hard push for separation, including many of the relevant court decisions, including those on school prayer. It was no accident that this occurred as the country was coming to terms with its historic treatment of minorities. I see the 60s as a time when we began to grow up a little bit, says Derek Davis, who's director of the Dawson Institute at Baylor University. If we wanted to be a democracy that supported the rights of minority groups, including religious minorities, he went on, we couldn't have a government that stood behind and supported one worldview. John F. Kennedy's election as president marked the full entry of Roman Catholics into the mainstream of American civic life. The civil rights movement sought to right historic wrongs done to African Americans. The era swept away longstanding barriers to Jews, the effective end of restrictive covenants, and new movements to defend the rights of newer immigrants from Latin America, Asia, and the Caribbean. And their numbers became even larger after the liberalization of immigration laws in 1965. In all their racial diversity, these groups brought with them religious diversity as well. All this brought the pervasively white and Protestant ethos in government-financed institutions and society, and including our schools, into question. The third stage of the debate, which we are going through now, I think, reflects a concern, and not just among Protestants or on the religious right, that the push to reduce Protestant Christianity's role may have had the effect of marginalizing faith's public role altogether. Was the public square not becoming not simply neutral, not simply more open, but actually hostile to religion? Religious conservatives certainly played a key role in this challenge. They decried the growing secularization of America and engaged in what the sociologist Nathan Glazer has called a defensive offensive. It was meant to restore the consensus on values that existed, or at least seemed to exist, before the 1960s. Naturally and reasonably, those dismayed by the religious right saw separation as a bulwark against the growing influence of organizations such as the Christian Coalition and the Moral Majority. But it's worth noting that most of the religious conservatives insisted that their goal was not the creation of a Christian nation, even if some in their ranks talked that way, but to preserve their own culture and faith commitments. The Christian conservatives cast themselves as a beleaguered minority suffering under the oppression of Washington and Hollywood. In a sense, as Glaser has written in another context, we are all multiculturalists now. Ralph Reed, the Christian conservative leader, was careful in his choice of words when he described his movement's goal. He said the Christian right sought, quotes, a place at the table. He did not propose to take ownership of the table or to drive others away from the table. You might argue that the phrase, a place at the table, especially when used by a leader of the religious conservative movement, represents the true triumph of religious pluralism in the United States. In sum, the third stage of our debate involves an effort to preserve the great gains in religious liberty that characterize the second stage, and yet also protect religion's free exercise and its role in our culture. Today's commotion, I think, is the product of a vigorous renegotiation of this public role for religion. At the heart of the renegotiation is the question raised by a Yale Law School professor, Stephen Carter, in the culture of disbelief. Is our nation replacing old prejudices of race and religion with a new prejudice against belief itself? Has religion been so pushed aside as a public matter that we have created what the Reverend Richard John Neuhaus called the naked public square? Now, I think this perhaps the clearest symbol of the difference between the second stage and the third stage is the sharp contrast between the way John F. Kennedy treated his faith as a public issue and how Joe Lieberman treated his. Both men, of course, broke barriers as representatives of minority religions, as non-Protestants in public life. But John Kennedy made the case for his own election on the grounds that his religion was not important at all to his role as a politician. His central assertion, politically necessary at the time, and perhaps even true, was that if ever his faith came into conflict with the Constitution or the public interest, he would resign. And in truth, few outside the most anti-Catholic quarters in America believed that was even remotely possible. As Arthur Schlesinger Jr. put it, it was hard to see any organic connection between Kennedy's faith and the rest of his public life. Joe Lieberman's approach could not have been more different. He praised God in public. He thanked God for his new public role. He spoke at length about the importance of his faith and about the legitimacy of a politician bringing his or her faith to the public arena. Unlike Kennedy, Lieberman said, my religion is really, really important to me. He recently joked that as a result of all this, he became known as Holy Joe, a title he said his mother quite liked, but that he didn't like at all. Now notice something else here. In order to win acceptance from Protestants, especially evangelical Protestants, it was absolutely essential for John F. Kennedy to play down his faith. But when Joe Lieberman played up his faith and spoke of God, it was said that he was doing so, doing exactly the opposite of what John F. Kennedy did, to reassure the very same groups of evangelical Protestants, or perhaps their children and their grandchildren. In Kennedy's time, the fear to be addressed was that a politician was not Protestant. In Lieberman's time, the fear that he addressed was that a politician was not religious enough. Thus, a characteristic difference between the second and the third stages of this great national debate. This is a huge historical shift, I think. There was once a time when separation of church and state was a cardinal commandment of Southern Baptists and nearly all evangelical Protestants. For most of those Protestants, spending even a dime of public money on religious schools or church programs was to assail the founders, destroy religious freedom, and turn God into a servant of the state. And it's worth recalling that a separationist argument that is now allied with pluralism was once directed against it. When Catholic immigrants began flooding into America from Ireland in the 1840s and later from elsewhere, there was strong Protestant opposition to any government assistance to the schools that the Catholics were establishing. Here, separationism was less about protecting government or religion than opposing any expansion of popery. Similar fights broke out from the late 40s through the late 60s over government aid to parochial schools, and Eleanor Roosevelt carried out a famous and bitter public argument with New York's Cardinal Spellman on the issue. What's striking now is that conservative Protestants who long opposed aid to Catholic schools now find themselves allied with Catholics on the voucher issue. One of the most remarkable changes of the 20th century is the virtual evaporation of hostility between Protestants and Catholics, says Grant Wacker of the Duke University Divinity School. I don't think it's because Baptists have come to have great respect for Tridentine theology, he went on. It's because they see Catholics as allies against graver problems. There is a large reconfiguration going on now. Now, I'd like to suggest that the third stage I've described, an attempt to honor both halves of the First Amendment, its free expression and its non-establishment clauses, has already borne some practical fruit. One example of successful renegotiation was offered in the 1995 federal guidelines to school administrators. They were designed to make clear that while the state cannot impose religion, students cannot be forced to be secular against their will or be silenced in their personal expressions of religion. These guidelines were worked out in very careful negotiations among groups ranging from the most separationist groups to groups such as the Christian Legal Society. There were people around that table who very rarely got together. The guidelines concluded that individual students at the and the guidelines came to a consensus on what the Constitution actually said. Individual students could not be stopped from praying. Jewish students could not be barred from wearing yarmulkes. Any kid who wanted to talk about religion on school grounds had the right to do so. As then-President Clinton said at the time, the Constitution does not require children to leave their religion at the classroom door. Another example of where the renegotiation has worked is in government employment. In 1997, using much the same process, the administration issued guidelines requiring government supervisors to respect individual expressions of faith by religious employees. Christians, the guidelines said, could keep Bibles on their desks. Muslim women could wear headscarves. Jewish workers should be accommodated as much as possible in scheduling so they could honor the high holy days. This may all seem like common sense, but it reflects an awareness that a desire to preserve religious freedom entails both keeping the government out of the way and protecting the free expression of believers. Now, despite these admirable attempts to work out these problems in a way that's simultaneously friendly to religious liberty and religious people, I don't want to pretend that this third stage I describe will magically succeed in creating some new consensus, let alone that it will be without controversy. Let's pause for a moment to address some of the objections to the idea that a third stage in our national debate is neither necessary nor desirable, is either necessary or desirable. Those in minority religions and those outside organized religion can plausibly argue that the assertion that religion is marginalized in the United States is absurd on its face. How can you say such a thing of a country that stamps "In God We Trust" on the currency? We are, by almost all measures, the most religious country in the world, judging by our own stated beliefs and by our participation at the houses of worship. The clergy play a larger role on all sides of the political debate. It would take too much time to list all of the religious lobbies that exist in Washington, and they exist on many sides of political issues. How many countries, it might be asked, have court cases over whether or not prayers should be said before football games? Some, and there are no doubt cynics, have suggested that this pointed to the importance not just of prayer, but also to football in our culture. And apropos that famous Texas football case, I think it's very important to note that issues of religious liberty are raised quite differently in different contexts, depending on whether there is a substantial or overwhelming religious majority that might exercise undue power over religious minorities. Charitable choice, for example, looks quite different in a large and religiously diverse metropolitan area than in a smaller and more religiously homogeneous community. In the metro area, seekers of service have a wide range of choice between public and private secular and religious providers. That choice may not exist elsewhere in our nation. And in truth, there is great ambivalence among Americans ourselves over these questions. A joint study by the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life and the Pew Research Center asked two questions in a poll recently, and I paraphrase here. Do you prefer as president someone who is a person of faith? And do you think it wrong for a politician to talk too much about how religious he is? In the same sample, 70% wanted a president with strong religious beliefs, but 50% disliked politicians who talk too much about their religiosity. A cynic might ask, how will Americans know about a politician's religious beliefs if he or she doesn't talk about them? But that finding, I think, is a lovely indicator of the torn mind and conscience of Americans when it comes to religion and public life. This conflict is carried out at a very personal level. My friend David Brooks has popularized the wonderful word flexidoxy to capture our ambivalence. Many Americans want the moral and spiritual certainty of orthodoxy. But being Americans and being of this time, they also want their orthodoxy to be flexible. They want orthodoxy, but without its rules against women or against birth control or against whatever it is they happen to be for. Thus, the popularity of flexidoxy. Because of this very American embrace of flexidoxy, I may be less worried about the new engagement of religion in public life than others are. It does seem to me to respond to genuine changes in American life. In its revised form, it reflects the nation's commitment to pluralism. I call your attention to Steve Wallman of BeliefNet, his op-ed piece in the New York Times today, where he noted that President Bush had to embrace religious pluralism in order to defend his faith-based initiative, and that that has made Pat Robertson somewhat nervous. And it reflects, I believe, not just the rise of the religious right, but also the reinvigoration of moderate and progressive religious traditions and denominations. As Leo Rebuffo, a historian and chronicler of the role of religion in American history, has noted, when a politician invokes Christianity as the justification behind his campaign or proposal, one must ask, do you mean Christianity in the sense of Niebuhr or Rauschenbusch? Or, for that matter, in the sense of Pat Robertson or Daniel Berrigan, the National Council of Churches or the Christian Coalition? This third stage, I think, would not be possible absent the renewal of progressive religious voices. It would not be seen as necessary absent a felt challenge in our society to find ways of tempering individualism with a sense of community, materialism with a set of values that put materialism in its place. Before closing, I'd like just to say a few words about President Bush's faith-based initiative. Bush is right, I think, and those of you who read me regularly know those words don't always easily come out of my mouth, but Bush is right to ask us to celebrate the miracles that happen every day in scores of church basements, child care centers, and prison fellowships. Bush himself did not invent the idea of government money flowing to or near or around religious institutions. Even before the current interest in charitable choice, government money helped support religiously based charities and social action projects. To pick the obvious, Medicare and Medicaid money has long been paid to religious hospitals. Government student loans have long helped students attending private and religious colleges. Lutheran services, Catholic charities, and the Jewish federations have long partnered with the government. Bush is also right, and here I think most liberals in the trenches helping communities and individuals know this already, that the government alone cannot expect to solve every social problem. Our systems of public assistance would collapse if non-governmental organizations, not limited to, but including the churches, were not doing their share. But there are challenges Bush must face and questions his administration will have to answer in advancing this initiative. First, I think the case for faith-based organizations cannot be that religious groups do their work better than non-religious groups, and that therefore the government should be biased in favor of religion. For one thing, there's not enough evidence to support that point, and plenty of evidence that voluntary secular groups and, yes, governmental groups do fine work. It is simply unacceptable constitutionally for the government to show preference for religious programs, even if that is only a vague preference for something called religion in general. The better case for the faith-based groups, and this at least for now is where Bush seems to be going, is that they're part of a broader network of voluntary organizations like Big Brothers and Big Sisters that deserve help, encouragement, and if carefully tailored, support from government. The point has to be to strengthen the voluntary sector as a whole. Second, and this is as much a challenge to the religious institutions as to the churches, there is a danger that greater dependence on government aid could still the prophetic voices of the churches in challenging government policies. There is a great debate going on within the African American church over whether this initiative is designed to change the political allegiances of what are now among the Democratic Party's most important organizational allies. A different but parallel fear from the conservative churches is that entanglement with government and government red tape could dilute the preaching of the whole gospel. From the point of view of religious people, there is a danger that these programs will so emphasize the instrumental character of religion, its capacity to create social service programs that work and that can pass various bureaucratic tests, that the question of whether what is being preached is true or not will be lost, and no tradition wants that lost. And if government aid truly does dilute what makes religious programs special, this could indeed turn out to be, as Melissa Rogers likes to say, the wrong way to do right. Third, Bush's generous words about the poor have to be tested against all of his proposals and not just this one. It will need to be said regularly for the next 4 years, a compassionate society doesn't leave families without health coverage, former welfare recipients without help in finding decent jobs, low-paid workers with no ladders out of poverty. It's good that Bush said, quotes, government will never be replaced by charities and community groups. Now by his works and his budgets and his priorities and his tax cuts shall we know him. And finally, and we're closing right where we started with Methodism, Bush's proper emphasis on personal responsibility of parents to their children, of the addicted to recovery, of former criminals to rehabilitation, cannot be used, I believe, as a way of denying social responsibility. Millions of people are poor not because they are flawed or irresponsible, or because of, but because of bad luck, discrimination, poor schools, dangerous neighborhoods, and injustices created by the economy itself. Compassion is good, but justice is better. Bush's compassionate conservatism should be measured not just by its intentions, but by whether it leaves our country more just than it is today. No society can depend on saints, even government-supported saints, to do all this work by themselves. Now, when one considers these questions, it's possible to see that this debate we're about to have over the Bush Initiative may give us a chance to grapple with some of the core tensions in our discussions over religion and public life, between the role of religious institutions as prophetic interrogators, in Jim Wallace's nice phrase, and its role as a practical, if loving, service provider, between the church's role in transforming individual lives and its role in calling society to account, and ultimately, to go back to Alan Wolfe's question, between religion's role in public and its role in private. Last year, I edited a book with John DiIulio, who has recently been appointed director of that White House office on faith-based and community initiatives. I actually had John at a conference, and I gave him a very warm introduction, and then I looked at him and said, John, I'd better shut up, because if somebody like me says too many nice things about you, the president will have to reconsider this appointment of you. We called our book, What's God Got to Do with the American Experiment? And we noted that that question might well provoke two legions to mass against each other. They'd offer sharply differing accounts of the role of God and organized religion in creating and nurturing the American experiment. In one view, it's America's pluralistic and secular constitution that has promoted freedom, diversity, and oddly, the very strength of America's religious communities. A state independent of organized religion has been freedom's and religion's finest friend. Was not a central motivation for the creation of free and tolerant institutions, a desire to end wars over God and religion. In the other account, freedom itself is rooted in a theistic commitment to the inviolable dignity of the individual human being. This belief arises, in the words of our own Declaration of Independence, from the law of nature and of nature's God. A belief in God places healthy restraints on the human tendency to deify political systems or individual political strongmen and insists that even strongmen are accountable to a higher authority. Now, in truth, these views are not mutually exclusive. Many Americans, for good reason, hold to both of them. And where religion is concerned, why shouldn't they? Let's be honest with ourselves and with each other. Religion can create community and it can divide communities. It can lead to searing self-criticism and it can promote pompous self-satisfaction. It can encourage dissent and conformity, generosity and narrow-mindedness. It can engender both righteous behavior and self-righteousness. Its very best and very worst forms can be inward-looking. Religion's finest hours have been the times when intense belief led to social transformation, yet in some of its darkest days have entailed the translation of intense belief into the ruthless imposition of orthodoxy. Now, I think that the history of the United States, despite many outbreaks of prejudice, nativism, and self-congratulation, is in large part a history of religion's role as a prod to social justice, inclusion, and national self-criticism. So I'd like to close with two views of religion's public role which suggests that at its best, it is prophetic and challenging, often dangerous to the powers that be, and friendly to those who are oppressed and heavily burdened. If these examples might seem designed to encourage liberals and people of the left to look upon the new discussion of religion and public life with a smidgen of sympathy, well, that is no accident, comrade. The first is from Michael Walzer's fine book, Exodus and Revolution. Walzer argues that the Exodus story has provided Western thought with one of its central themes of oppression and deliverance, of the idea that the door of hope always remains open. We still believe, Walzer writes, or many of us do, what the Exodus first taught about the meaning and possibility of politics and about its proper form. And he makes three points. First, that wherever you live, it is probably Egypt. Second, I love that line. Second, that there is a better place, a world more attractive, a promised land. And third, that the way to the land is through the wilderness. There is no way to get from here to there without joining together and marching. And then there is the historian Richard Whiteman Fox, reflecting on the work of that anti-utopian Christian realist Reinhold Niebuhr and the historian Christopher Lash. Both, Fox said, understood that religion can be seen both as a democratic social power, a capacity to build community, and as a tragic perspective that acknowledges the perennial failings of human beings to make community endure. Religion, he goes on, allows people to grapple with the human mysteries that neither science nor politics can address, but it also provides a force that science and politics can call on in their effort to understand and transform the social world. Fox, I believe, explains why God and questions about God will always be central to the American experiment. He explains why we are destined to revisit over and over and over again the relationship between religion and our aspirations to pluralism, freedom, and democracy. Only by doing so will we be able to respect the serious moral commitments of believers and unbelievers alike, and only by doing so will we preserve free expression and religious liberty. Thank you.
EJ says I'll take a few questions. Run it yourself.
One question you haven't addressed is, what about the role of a new spirituality in public life? What role do the word that's derisively called New Age, the various forms of alternative religion that come out of the 60s, what role, if any, do they have in public life? The religious right doesn't like them because they are regarded as quote-unquote false religion, and they consider themselves them to be relativists. The secular left considers them to be escapists, but what role will they have in public life and life, if any? I mean, have they had in our public life, what role do you see them having?
A couple of things. One is, I think that the faith-based initiative is going to raise some fascinating questions about how inclusive are we toward various religious traditions, including, if you will, the New Age traditions. Will a New Age group be able to apply for funds for, say, drug treatment? And I think one of the fascinating questions about this initiative is, a question Mary Jo Bain raised, she used to work in the Clinton administration, she's a great academic. She said, I look at these things as a bureaucrat, and the question is, how will you define religion? Will you have a bureaucrat writing definitions of religion? Now, the IRS actually does have some definitions of religion, which I suspect may extend to some of the New Age groups. So I do think there will be, I think those issues will come to the fore in a way they didn't before because of the faith-based initiatives. I think the other side to that is, and this is where my knowledge of the New Age groups becomes thinner and thinner, so I'll be careful in what I say. It's my impression that some are much more socially conscious and have links between these spiritual beliefs and some forms of social action. Others are extremely inward-looking, very much a kind of personalistic faith, and not even faith, personalistic spirituality. My hunch is that the second group will have a limited effect on public life. But again, my understanding is that's not true of the whole New Age movement. Sir?
You mentioned law at the very end of your talk. What I'm concerned about is the absence, for example, of presidential campaigns, both primary and the final one. So little reference to foreign policy. And in connection with religion, I'm thinking of pacifism and conscientious objection. When we witness the extent to which Bush is favoring, I think it's fair to say, military and the policies in connection with that, it seems to me is a real menace. I'm thinking in terms, for example, of the resurrection of Star Wars. I'd like some comment if you have the time for it.
Did people in the back hear the question? Tell me if I'm fair to your question. The gentleman asked, why there was so little discussion of foreign policy in the presidential campaign. He's concerned about the revival of Star Wars or the missile shield. And also he talked about the role of pacifists in politics. If I can sort of start with the last point and move to the other briefly. You know, historically, the religious groups have been not only at the heart of many of these arguments over war and peace, going back to World War I, you know, with the foundation of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, which was started out as a group of Christian pacifists who later expanded to include a much wider group of Americans. There's a group that discovered American pluralism as it went along. You know, through the debates before World War II, there was a fascinating split among Christians, where the Christian Century, a magazine of liberal Protestantism, opposed American involvement in World War II, and Reinhold Niebuhr split off and founded a magazine called Christianity in Crisis because he believed we needed to intervene against the Nazis. I don't think the religious community will be any less vocal in this debate over weapons and military spending than they've been in the past. Where their energy has tended to go is less on direct foreign policy questions than to subjects such as debt relief. There wouldn't have been debt relief in the last Congress but for the intervention of mostly progressive, but not entirely progressive, religious groups. Groups such as Bread for the World played a big role in that. As to the broader question, I don't want to digress too much on foreign policy, which is not my area of expertise and not what the talk is about, but I think you will see, I don't think you have to worry about the military budget or the missile defense system being debated vigorously. And if I could just pass along a view of a Republican foreign policy friend, he once said that the missile defense issue is the most theological issue in American politics. He said Republicans would be for it even if it didn't work, if it were proven that it didn't work, and Democrats would be against it even if it were proven it did work. And I think there's something to that. But thank you, sir. Sir, Kevin.
Groups, what for me the value is seeing very progressive religious leaders and fundamentalists unifying around progressive views for the environment. The danger is using very specific language from scripture, you know, protect each species two by two or whatever, as prescriptions in politics. So can you comment on that at all?
See, what often happens at events like this is the person asking the question has vast knowledge that he should share with the audience. Kevin Sweeney has done a lot of very good environmental work, just to say that to the audience. This whole idea of stewardship, as you know, is better than I, has become very powerful among Christians, and Christian groups have become more more activist on the environment. And in general, as you suggest, a lot of fairly conservative religious groups have actually taken what we look at as progressive stance on environmental issues. I guess my feeling about the use of scripture is that the obligation of a citizen is not to say that his or her religious views have nothing to do with the conclusions that he or she reaches. I think as citizens we are free to reach our conclusions on whatever basis we wish. That our obligation in a pluralistic democracy is to make a public case for our convictions that is not dependent on the particular religious commitment. Essentially, I mean, I'm a Catholic. I know my views on social justice are very much shaped by the fact that I'm a Catholic. But I can't say to somebody, we should do more for the poor because my church or my reading of the gospel says so. I have to make a secular case, a case that's open to anybody, whether they agree with me or not. And my sense is a lot of religious people who are involved in movements like that understand the discipline of democracy and pluralism, and that discipline requires of them to make public arguments in a way that is different from the original reasons for reaching the conclusion they did. If I could just say a small word about Bush and his Jesus comment. I always thought that it was not a problem that he said Jesus was his favorite political philosopher. That actually is useful information to voters. That answer was very useful. What bothered me was when he said, if you didn't experience this, you wouldn't know what it is. And that Father Brian Hare, who's the dean of the Harvard Divinity School, made a wonderful comment where he said the first part is legit because we want to know that, but that there is an obligation in pluralism to speak to everyone, and you can't retreat that way. Gary Bauer actually gave, in that same debate, a better answer when he said, talked about the obligations to feed the hungry and house the homeless, and gave a very specific program where you could say, okay, that is a way in which you could see Jesus as a political philosopher. And the inimitable Alan Keyes trumped Bush the next day when he said, Jesus isn't a philosopher, Jesus is the Word, which I think is strictly orthodox. Sir?
Just in terms of the church as a political action, if you think about it, the 60s, the activist church, you think primarily African-American, civil rights left, if you will, and then it sort of calmed down. The only political church in the 80s was primarily white and to the right and very conservative. And I'm wondering if overall it's too cynical to say that maybe it has, the activist political church has less to do with faith and more to do with maybe just charismatic leadership locally or broad, or the way you refer to as political strongman.
Did people hear the question in the back? It was basically noting that there was an activist left church in the 60s, especially in the African-American community, that this was replaced by a kind of activist conservative church, especially in the white community in the 80s. And the question was, does this have more to do with the existence of charismatic leaders or political...
politically connected charismatic.
Yeah. I mean, I think everything in politics has to do with the issues on the table, and that the civil rights movement succeeded beginning in the 40s and 50s in putting racial justice on the table, and that became a central moving issue in American political life, and people had to take sides, and the church was very divided. A King's letter from a Birmingham jail takes to task religious leaders who kind of wanted to go gradually and not move as he saw fast enough. It's a very powerful document, that letter. And then came the war in Vietnam, which also created quite a significant amount of activism on the religious left. Clergy and laity concerned about the war was one of the more powerful of the anti-war groups, and then the old pacifist groups. I think that the reason I cite Nathan Glazer is I think he has a very interesting sort of take on where the religious right came from after that. And I think it was a specific response to issues. And there were issues such as the school prayer decision, which was seen as marginalizing religion's role in the schools. They were the abortion decision, which the religious right saw as a way of taking this decision out of the hands of the political system and just by fiat abolishing abortion. It was also a revolt against the broader culture. It was a kind of revolt against the 1960s in a sense that they were being treated with disrespect by the broader culture. I don't think Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson would have gotten anywhere if there hadn't been in that community this sense of being beleaguered by various forces in the culture. I think what's happening now is that, in fact, most people in that community realize they have found their place at the table. There is more respect, if you will, for the views. There is less baiting of rednecks. There is less talk like that, even among liberals. I think that people have learned some lessons about what it means to disrespect other people. And obviously, after the Reagan years, there was a sense of inclusion. And then I think what you're seeing now is a revival of a kind of, I think, an older sort of progressive religious tradition that goes back to the period of the civil rights period, but also to people like Niebuhr back in the 40s and 50s. There are organizations like Call to Renewal that are organizing people around poverty. The National Council of Churches has made a major commitment to organizing people around the issues of poverty. And so I think you're seeing a modest revival of that kind of mainstream, mainline sort of religious progressivism that is not just confined to Protestantism. I mean, you're seeing it. You see it in the Jewish community. You see it in the Catholic Church. I see some stirrings of it in the Muslim community. And I think that's a very interesting development. There are a bunch of people up at the Harvard Divinity School and the Kennedy School at Harvard who put out a wonderful little book, a book of essays, which struck me as a kind of wonderful recreation of this tradition of sort of social justice engagement by religious communities. So I think something is happening. I don't think it'll hit us in the face the way the religious right did or the way the religious left did during the Vietnam War, but I think it's a kind of constructive building that's going on. Sir? Yeah.
I wonder, something I've noticed about the public discourse on the question of religion and politics is that the question of how the state or the politics may change religion generally receives less attention than the question of how religion may change
There's a question about how the public discourse talks more about religion changing the state than the state changing religion. I thought I had actually talked about that. It's interesting,
well,
because it's a very interesting question, and I think there are a lot of people who are, if you will, religious separationists, who are much more worried about the impact government will have on the churches. Then, you know, they don't believe that the churches are going to corrupt the government. They believe the government will corrupt the churches. And what's interesting about that view is it really exists at many different points on the political and religious spectrum. I organized a meeting of lots of people to talk about some of these issues, and there was a wonderful man from the Gospel Missions who got up, and he said, just so you know who we are, we're the people who hit you over the head with a Bible and pour soup down your throat. And he was very, very skeptical. This was before, but this was a couple of years back. He was very skeptical of these initiatives because he wanted to preach the full gospel, and he didn't want anybody getting in the way of that, including especially the government. Similarly, the African-American church, there is great ferment over this Bush initiative, and that, because there's an anger at Bush in a lot of those churches after the recount fight. There's a kind of mistrust. They are, you know, African Americans are overwhelmingly Democratic, as are African American pastors. And so there's great worry, is this an attempt to buy us off? Is this something we should engage in? On the other hand, there is a long history of engagement with the government by the African American churches. I think one of the ironies of this initiative is that there's a study by Mark Chavez at the University of Arizona where he does an annual survey of churches, and what he discovered is that African American churches are far more likely to take advantage of charitable choice programs than white churches, and moderate and liberal churches are far more likely to take advantage of these programs than conservative churches. So the irony is you could have a conservative initiative that will strengthen the liberal base in politics. And so I think that you've got, you know, I think people are reflecting both sides of this. But I agree, I think in some ways the much more interesting question is what is the impact of the state on these churches? And that's what the religious separationists are going to be talking about. Ma'am.
Yeah.
Division, I came in late, what were you saying?
Gay rights and gay marriage, especially when you look at issues like the Boy Scout case, where you have an organization claiming religiosity in order to protect against that kind of
boy, that there is no issue, I think, that is more divisive right now within the churches than the issue of gay and lesbian rights. And it's harder. I think it's a much harder issue for the churches than it is for the government. And it's not easy for the government. But it is relatively easy for the government to conclude, and I think there's been some movement among conservatives on this, to say, okay, the government should not formally discriminate against people because of their sexual orientation. For the churches, it's extremely difficult because there are a set of positions going back a very long way, and churches do. Tradition is not always permissible in government as a justification for something. It is permissible in the churches. And so these fights, I think, are going to split some of the, could split some of the denominations. What's funny about this is I don't see those fights reflecting themselves so much in politics. This is, I think, a case of the social world entering into the churches and creating these divisions. And, you know, I think for some years, I think it will take longer for the churches to work their position on this than it will for the government. Sir?
You're wonderfully descriptive. But some of the words you're using, I can't understand very well. It seems to me that the differences that you speak of so eloquently and so accurately to me are all based on the difference between rationality and faith. And to me, I thought that you were going to be talking about a movement toward rationality and away from the million warring sects, to borrow the term from Fitzgerald. Could you comment on the concept of rationality as a growing belief, as opposed to all these different faiths that we're going to somehow or other going to get to work together? Because each faith works from an essentially arbitrary and random base, and they just appear magically, and then we're supposed to figure out how to get them all together in a social or political context. Do you see any movement in the direction away from this constant randomness?
The man has asked such a profound question, it's going to be hard for me to summarize it. But did people get the sense of his question in the back? Okay. Maybe there may be two separate issues going on here. One is whether you think rationality is sort of the enemy of faith. And that is a profound argument in theology, and that I personally do not believe rationality is the enemy of faith. So I think in some sense I disagree with the premise of the question. There are people whose faith can be irrational, but faith itself is not irrational, and that most people can give reasons and rational accounts for how they get to where they are in their faith, and that indeed some of the disputes between and among churches are rooted in reasoned argument over the meaning of the meaning of the very scriptures that they espouse and the meaning of their notions of God and the identity of, say, in the case of Christians, the identity of Jesus. So I don't believe the country is moving toward a rationality that excludes religion. If anything, the evidence is on the other side. There is considerable evidence on the other side that there is a kind of modest religious revival going on. And again, it depends on your point of view. I do not see that as an enemy of rationality. And in fact, I see in among, if you will, religious intellectuals, an attempt to re-enter the debate with secular intellectuals to present a set of presumptions that may have been left out of that, because a lot of secular intellectuals do believe that it is hocus pocus and irrational. So I think I may have dissatisfied you in part because I may have a somewhat different premise. Is that fair? A fair response to your question? Yeah. Okay. And this is America, and we can do that. Thank God.
Take one more, but an easy one.
Sort of semi-serious, but I'm wondering, you speak of this revival of the sort of Niebuhrian progressive. In this third stage, is there going to be a room for a public theologian like Reinhold Niebuhr to reappear?
Well, you know, I love that question. That's a great question to close on. I'm just curious, how many people know who Reinhold Niebuhr is? In the, oh, God bless you all. That's great. Well, he's right, yes. So we agree on Niebuhr. We all, yeah. Oh, is that?
Didn't know left already.
You know, Niebuhr is the author of two of my favorite lines. One is that original sin is the only empirically verifiable doctrine of the Christian church. And the other is that man's capacity for good makes democracy possible, and man's capacity for evil makes democracy necessary. And, you know, I've had this conversation with a number of people in the last few months about whether there is room in our public life for Reinhold Niebuhr. How would Reinhold Niebuhr do on Chris Matthews' show? Or how would Reinhold Niebuhr do on Crossfire? I mean, what is it about? Is there something in the nature of our political discourse that makes it harder for someone like that to have a strong public role? Are we, you know, because I think some of this, and this goes back to what I was talking to the gentleman about, I think there is a tendency to see religious spokespeople as either irrational or representing particular interest groups, and not as representing a coherent a coherent worldview that can be talked about in a rational way with people who may or may not share that particular worldview. I just hope, you know, I guess what I want to do is make a leap of hope and faith that say if the next Reinhold Niebuhr or several of them appear in our nation, that they will be compelling enough that we're going to begin to listen to them. But I do think there's something in the culture that makes it harder to happen now than to happen in the 40s. And I don't say that to be nostalgic. I just think that there is a problem. But as I say, I am guardedly optimistic because I think there are people struggling back toward that kind of public voice for religion, and I surely think that would be a good thing. And I want to thank everyone again for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.
Tomorrow, 3:00, Northgate Hall is the wilderness. And at 5:00 at Moses Hall, the Promised Land, Thank you.
Oh, thank you.